Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What's a fair way to decide who gets into what college? For a long time, we have looked at students' grades, SAT scores, and extracurricular activities to gauge their talent and ability. But while numbers on a page would seem to reflect nothing more than individual ambition and ability, a broader examination of the context in which they are earned reveals something else. Student achievement tends to track very closely with parental income. So elite schools continue to court the children of elite families, while many highly promising but less privileged young people are elbowed out of the way by a system that is supposed to reward hard work and potential. And as my guest will tell us, it is rare indeed for colleges to consider what their students might do for society if they had access to a first-class education. Lonnie Guinier is Bennett Bosky Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. Her new book is called The Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. Lonnie, welcome to Think.
Thank you for inviting me.
The standard term is meritocracy, but you think it could better be called testocracy. How important are the tests these days in getting into a good school?
The test scores are very important in terms not only of getting into college, but getting into law schools and other forms of higher education.
And they matter more even than grades?
Well, they matter more than grades in the sense that people go to different schools and grades at the different schools can mean something differently, whereas if you take one standardized test that people across the nation are taking, then the scores at least appear to have a more consistent consistent credibility.
What do we know about the relationship between SAT and MCAT or LSAT scores and actual performance once students are in a program?
Well, I happen to know a lot about one of those elements of higher education, and that's law school. And I know about it because when I was a professor at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, I was able to convince the dean to give me the data on 4 years of students that included their LSAT scores, their undergraduate GPA, as well as their GPA in the law school. And it turned out that the LSAT was a very weak predictor of first, second, and third academic grades at the law school. The LSAT predicted 14% of the variance in first-year grades. It did a little bit better second year, 15% of the variance, meaning 85% of the time it was wrong. And 85% is a lot bigger a number than 15%. Which the 15% in the second year of law school were those whose LSAT scores predicted their grades.
And it turns out it's not only schools that make the mistake of assuming those who score the highest must be the best students by their own merit. Students themselves believe this fallacy.
Well, part of it, it's hard to predict what students are thinking these days because it's become more and more challenging and more competitive. When I was in college or applying to law school, there wasn't as much pressure on people to do well on the tests. There was much more reliance on your GPA. And that in part was because the school was relying on fewer locations on which various students were seek from that location, from that high school, from that special high school, from that expensive high school. They were the students who were more likely to get into Harvard when I was there, certainly, and that was in the late 1970s.
Tell us, Lonnie, what we know about how overall standardized test scores reflect not just where you went to, say, high school, but family assets more directly.
Oh, you know, that's absolutely true. And there's a very interesting book by a man named Andrew Ferguson, who is talking about his own son's effort to graduate from high school and get into college. And the author went down to Washington, D.C. to try to see what was happening with U.S. News and World Reports in terms of the ranking of the various schools that his son might be interested in applying to. And he discovered, at least according to his book, that there was only one person in the entire building, or at least only one person who was taking charge in the entire building. It was otherwise pretty much quiet. And that one person was somewhat arbitrarily denoting which schools were number one, number two, number three for U.S. News and World Report, and then everyone else relies on what this one gentleman is saying that affects thousands and thousands of decisions.
Wow. And the way that students score, just to go back to this for a minute, for every $10,000 in family income, there's a predictable rise in SAT scores.
Yes, because it's not that the students of privilege are smarter than poor or working class students. It's that the students of privilege have more access to practicing and getting tutors to help them prepare for the test and to understand the ways in which you can do best on the test by not only practicing, but by understanding that there are certain assumptions that are behind the questions. And that was the other thing Andrew Ferguson talked about when in terms of his investigation of his son's efforts to get into college. He went to several events where his son's fellow students' parents were, and they were all talking about what they were doing to get their kids into particular schools. And it was quite a regimen. And you can understand why parents are doing that, because they want their kids to go to institutions of higher education that have a high reputation, and that having been to that institution, their child, when graduating, will be more, it'll be easier for them to get a job. But the whole vision of higher education as promoting democracy, the whole mission of higher education that David Laborie, who's a professor at Stanford in the education school, talks about, the mission of democracy, of building citizens, that and citizens, not just people who are prepared to vote in elections every 2 or 4 years, but people who truly see themselves as making a contribution to the larger society, not just to their own bank account.
I want to talk about the question of race-based preference. One problem with well-meaning policies that say we would like the incoming freshman class to reflect the ethnic diversity of the U.S. population in general is that you can actually do that from a pool of minority students who come from privileged backgrounds, who all attended the best schools. You're not necessarily reflecting socioeconomic diversity.
That's true, and that's not limited to issues of race. That's about issues of class, and that affects white students as well as poor and working class black students or poor and working class Latinos.
Do top schools or colleges in general simply need to cater to students who can pay full tuition rates?
Well, that's certainly the answer is yes. And it's certainly understandable because it's become more and more expensive to run a college or run a university. And part of the expense is the expense of paying for professors. The amount that we get paid at Harvard Law School is much higher, much, much higher now than it was when I first started in teaching law back in 1988. And so it's understandable that institutions of higher education are looking for sources, for resources that will help sustain them. But that doesn't mean they have to rely primarily on SATs or other kinds of measurements if what they're really trying to do is to educate the next generation of leaders. And by leaders, I'm going back to what I said earlier, leaders in a democracy, not just leaders in an effort to improve their own personal lives and to take advantage of the advantages that they've been born into.
I don't want to pick specifically on Harvard here, but I happen to look up the tuition rates, and that's where you work. And it's, you know, approximately like between $62,000 and $68,000 a year now for full tuition and room and board and basic expenses. For, I would imagine, all but the absolute wealthiest families, like the 1% of the 1%, it simply doesn't make sense to send a student to Harvard who then wants to teach in an inner city public school for $40,000 a year.
Well, there's so. Can we go? Your question has at least three or four.
Feel free to unpack it at will. Yeah, absolutely.
But I have to, in some ways, take you off to a different road, although it's generated by what you just said, and that is. In the Harvard Crimson, about within the past 10 years, there was an article in the Crimson that it was entitled "Show Him the Money," and it was in the graduation issue of the Crimson, or in an issue that was very close to when students were about to graduate, and it was a critique of the women students graduating from Harvard College because they had done a survey, and it turned out that the male students, when they were graduating or getting ready to graduate from Harvard, they were interested in working on Wall Street. They wanted to make a lot of money. Their goal was to become very powerful. The women, by contrast, at least according to this particular study, wanted to work as teachers, or they wanted to make a contribution to the larger society. So the women were more what I would call meritocratic in a democracy-oriented way, and the men were oriented in a plutocracy form of merit. And the irony is that the men, or at least the Crimson, was critical of the women who wanted to be lawyers not so much lawyers, but doctors and teachers, as if there was something wrong with them because they weren't as interested in getting the money. And the title, as I said, was "Show Him the Money," that the male students graduating from Harvard seemed to be more interested in.
That's not necessarily the university's perspective. I mean, it was in the Crimson, but that doesn't reflect the way most educators at Harvard feel, does it?
No, I don't think I don't think that. Yes, I agree with you. My point is the atmosphere and the culture of higher education has been tainted by this competitiveness, this individualistic competitiveness, in which students are competing against each other in order to make a lot of money rather than working together, collaborating to solve some of the problems of this society, which their talents are very much in need of contributing.
Lonnie Guinier is with us. She's Bennett Bosky Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and author of the new book, The Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. If you'd like to weigh in or ask a question, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or send us a tweet at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/mls.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour as part of KERA's American Graduate Initiative with Lonnie Guinier. She is Bennett Bosky Professor of Law at Harvard Law School and author of the new book, The Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. You can be part of our conversation by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think at kera.org or send me a tweet at Chris Boyd Think. So, Lonnie, you talked about the importance of students who are able to work collaboratively, with others. What makes this sort of ability important in terms of really functioning for the good of society once a student is finished with school?
Well, I think Scott Page, who's a professor at the University of Michigan, has a good way of explaining the answer to your particular question. He says, what if you were interested in hiring two people, but you want to have two people who are very smart and who are going to make a contribution, and you end up with some people who got, and you give everybody 10 questions, and some people got most of the questions right, but they ended up getting some of the key questions wrong. And so his inquiry is it more important that people answered more right answers, or is it more important that you have a group of people and from which you're going to pick two or three to work and problem solve because they answered a lot of questions and they answered different questions correctly. And so if you put them together, you have a group of people who have a range of perspectives that they bring to the table, and that gives the workers, gives the people who are trying to solve the problem a sense gives them the benefit of variety of perspectives and variety of information. And so what Scott Page is saying is that you don't want people all of whom do well on a particular test. You also want people who make up an important posse or an important group of people who bring different skills to the table and, as a result, improve the group's skills more generally. And there's work by Anita Woolley, who's at Carnegie Mellon. She has looked at a study, or she has been part of a study, in which there was a question whether the men or the women were better at solving problems. And it turned out that the more women you had in the group, the better the group was at addressing the particular problem and trying to solve it. And the difference was that the men were trying to demonstrate how smart they were in the groups, whereas the women were truly trying to solve the problem. And so what I'm trying to suggest, and this is based on the work of many other professors and experts, it's not just can you answer yes or no questions and get good grades and therefore be considered a potentially good person with whom to collaborate, or are we looking for groups of people who have a range of skill sets, a range of experiences, a range of challenges, and get them to work together so that you're benefiting from the perspectives of from multiple perspectives, and as a result, you're much better informed and you're much more likely to come up with important and influential conclusions. So that the idea is not just to make the people who are being challenged to solve a problem feel more important. The challenge is to solve the problem.
And of course, that's often how it works in, a well-streamlined workplace. Everyone has something that they are particularly adept at that ideally they bring to the group, and they sort of manage for the group so that together they can produce the best possible results.
Exactly. And so that's the theme of the book, is the value of collaboration and the importance of encouraging people to work together with people who are different than they are, but different in a way that's constructive, not different in a way that's just going to undermine the capacity of the group to work.
What do you do about this, Lonnie? And perhaps you've seen this with your students. Certainly it happens at the undergraduate level. Many people complain about doing group work because they worry that somehow it's going to unfairly favor those who slack off or who don't have as much to bring to the table.
Well, I think that's a fair criticism. But I have to say that in the past 10 years, I have used the opportunity for students to work together to solve problems as part of their requirements. So, for example, I'm teaching a course this semester in which I teach the first half of the course, but then I work with the students in small groups so that they lead the conversation for the second half of the course. And in the process, the students become really engaged and really focused, because this is an opportunity for them to develop skills, and it's an opportunity for them to learn from each other, not just from the books that they read. And it also is inviting of the students who are in the class and are participating in the group leadership but are not the leaders themselves that week, that everybody is just more invested in the class, and that they come away 2 years, 3 years, 5 years later, 10 years later, writing me notes telling me how important that class was for them in thinking about why they were in law school and what they really wanted to do once they graduate.
You cite in the book an interesting study by Uri Treisman, who looked at two different groups of students studying math. Are you familiar with the study that I just cited?
Absolutely.
Tell us about that, will you?
Sure. Well, when Professor Treisman was a graduate student at Berkeley, he was teaching calculus, and he noticed that the Chinese-American students were doing very well in his calculus class and the African-American students were not. And he was curious as to why the Asian-American students were doing so well, and he hired some other graduates who had access to they had access to machinery or to instruments that would allow them to follow the Asian American students around and to determine what it is that they're doing that made them so successful in calculus. And also another group followed around the black students to see the way in which they were preparing for class. It turned out that the black students prepared for class and were serious about it and took time, but they did it all by themselves in their own dorm rooms. The Chinese-American students talked about calculus all day. They walked to class talking about calculus. They went to lunch and talked about the questions that they were being challenged to answer. And what Treisman decided is that there was something very important in the pedagogical stream of students teaching each other, not just listening to the professor lecture. And he started a program where he invited the black students to come and do just what the Asian American students were already doing. He served food, and he had them work together to solve the calculus problems that the students had been assigned. And it had a remarkable and very positive effect on the black students, whose grades improved tremendously. Very similar to that, Eric Mazur, who's a physics professor, and he's a physics professor at Harvard, and he had been teaching elementary physics to a very large group of students, and it was an interaction in which he would talk and they would just write notes. And what worried him is that the women, in this particular case, were not doing as well as the men in first-year calculus. So that's what stimulated him to experiment. And in his case, the way he experimented was that he asked the students to let them know three or four things that they couldn't understand when they were preparing for their next calculus, excuse me, for their next physics course. And he would then pick some of the questions, and he would ask the whole class to answer the question that he put up on the board, and they could answer it A, B, C, or D, and they had clickers. And what he discovered is that when the students clicked their answers, some of them got it right, but not all of them. And rather than identify the students who didn't get it right, he had the students talk to each other, that is, those sitting near each other, and he found that it was the students who had gotten it right and who had just learned physics who were the best at teaching their peers. And it was because they were closer to the challenges that their peers were facing. And so they were thus closer to where to intervene in fixing the problem. So what Professor Mazur found that the women students who hadn't been doing as well as the men students in physics started to do much better as once he started this new curriculum, this new form of teaching. And he's continued to use that because it's a very powerful tool to get people to teach each other.
So that's a beautiful model once you have students together at any academic institution. But of course, as we all know, you don't have groups of, say, 9 students applying together to any university saying, together we're the most amazing team and you should look at us this way.
Well, actually, you do have that with the Posse Foundation.
Well, talk a little bit more about how they do things and how that works to the advantage of students who are involved.
Okay, and then we'll get to your question. Okay. I'm sorry for interrupting.
That's all right. You made a good point.
So the Posse program was started when a student or a former student of Diane Beale was he was admitted to a school and went to the school and then dropped out of it within a few months. And she ran into him maybe 6 months after he had started school, and she discovered he was not thriving. And he said to her, if I had had my posse, I could have stayed. And she then decided there was a lot of, quote, merit in his response, and she started a program called the Posse Program, in which institutions of higher education are invited to admit an entire posse, not just one person. And what the Posse program tries to do is to identify what the strengths and weaknesses are of the students who are applying to be part of the Posse program. And they try to put together a group of students that are capable of working together and that represent lots of diversity and lots of different perspectives so that the group can benefit from the intelligences, the ideas that are very well understood, but well understood differently by each of the members of the posse. And then the institutions of higher education, for example, Middlebury, which admits posse students, they admit a group of 8 to 10 students, not just one student. And those students succeed very well in higher education, in college, at Middlebury and elsewhere.
I'm actually glad we took the time to talk about that seemingly radical idea. What about institutions that are not necessarily willing to make a change like that or to be open to something like this? What can students and schools that are trying to send students to these schools do to sort of give themselves a better shot?
Well, I think one, certainly you said one thing, so I think one thing is to encourage more students to go to community college and to introduce this concept at the community college level, because I think it's more likely that students who go to community college and then who are there with a posse will succeed because they have the power the love or concern and the different perspectives of a group of students who are very much like them, but who together encourage them, reinforce them, give them the energy, remind them as to why they're there, and they feel emboldened. So I would encourage more of the posse arrangement in community college, which would then prepare students for what I hope would be another form of building friends, building building people who you can work with, and who provide an alternative way of thinking about solving problems. An alternative way meaning I'm not going to compete with you in order to solve this problem. I'm going to work with you so that we can both solve it together.
So many of the challenges that you're describing sound like the flip side of this thing that we really value in ourselves as Americans, which is this belief in kind of independent control over our own destiny.
Competitive individualism.
Yeah.
Well, that's why we need a culture shift. And I think I'm not saying that competitive individualism is terrible. I'm just saying it alone is not adequate in a society in which opportunity is so unfairly distributed. You can compare, for example, what they do in Canada in terms of getting into institutions of higher education. And as I understand it, if you get over an 80 in your grades, you are admitted to a college in Canada, and I think you're given six options, and they will pick one of them, but you are guaranteed a position. So part of it is to change the culture, that this is not about competitive individualism. This is about investing in the future, and consistent with David Laperre's idea that there's a democratic mission to higher education, not just a competitive mission.
Lonnie Guinier is with us. We're talking about her new book, The Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies programs. Accepting applications for summer and fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in human rights, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. More at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Professor Lonnie Guinier of Harvard Law School. Her new book is called The Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. Join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. We have an email here from Kelly in Dallas who writes, I'm a perennial 99%er on standardized tests, but I absolutely know that these tests in no way measure creativity or collaborative skills or empathy or ethicality, all critical skills in a healthy, successful society. How can colleges and employers identify these traits and encourage them?
Well, I'm not sure I understand the question. Is the question that these people have inherited or inherent talents that should be developed by the professors?
I'm going to assume it's an email here, so I can't ask Kelly, but I'm going to assume that it's really about how we can encourage maybe universities to look for things beyond the test scores on a page and the record of extracurricular activities that, you know, sort of were performed.
Yes.
For purposes of looking good on a resume.
Right. And I don't have any objection to that. My concern is not that the people who run the admissions program are making bad choices. My intervention or my concern is in the emphasis within institutions of higher education and within the education system more generally in the United States. The emphasis is is about competitive individualism. It's about people taking tests so they can show that they're smarter than other people who are taking the test. And it may be that in terms of taking the test, they are smarter. But the problem is taking the test does not correlate well with doing well in life or doing well in your profession. The tests are not very well, they're not good predictors. And I say that because I had the opportunity, as I said earlier, to look at the LSAT scores of 4 years of students at the University of Pennsylvania Law School. It's an excellent school. And it turned out that if you look at the undergraduate GPA and you look at the LSAT scores of the students, the students with the highest LSAT were not necessarily the students who did the best in law school. The LSAT was a weak predictor of performance. And it wasn't simply about women or men. It was simply that the LSAT did not, it predicted 14% of the variance, meaning 86% of the time it was wrong. So my point is we've gotten young people all caught up in trying to take a test that it turns out is more of a test of how much money your parents are making, because the people who do better on the LSAT are the people whose parents make more money. And why do they do better? It's not because their parents are smarter than other people's parents. It's that their parents have more money to pay for them to take take the money and get guidance, pay somebody to help them, to teach them how do you take this test and what are the best ways of answering different questions, et cetera. So what the tests are actually telling us, and this is this is a humorous metaphor that Jesse Rothstein, who's a professor at Berkeley but was a professor at Princeton, he's an economics professor, and his point was basically that the SAT can tell you, your SAT score is better at telling you what kind of car your parents drive than what kind of grades you're going to get first year in college.
I would imagine that a lot of the points you're making absolutely ring true for people who have had these experiences, who have maybe not had the best test scores but gone on to do quite well in life and, in fact, quite well, you know, in a university setting. I wonder, though, if you have more trouble making this case to people who look, say, at their own children slaving over assignments and say, well, we may be well off, but my child, you know, it has gotten here on his or her own merit.
Well, they can say that. I'm not in argument with them. The point is that we are in a democracy, and their children should do well in school, and their children should benefit from going to school. Nobody's trying to take that away from their children. What, at least not me. What I'm trying to do is to bring greater diversity to the institution, so that their children, who come from privileged households, get a better sense of what it's like to be poor, get a better sense of the way in which we distribute wealth in this country, get a better sense of the challenges that other people have had to face that were not challenges that they ever knew about. So this is about democratizing higher education in America. That's the subtext of the book. It's not trying to punish or ridicule people who are doing well because of their wealth.
What do you do about the argument some people have made, and it is backed with some data, that taking even a student with great potential who, for whatever reason, on these tests in grades hasn't matched up to classmates, ends up with a student mismatched in a particular university setting or program, and you're actually putting that student at a greater disadvantage rather than helping them by getting them into the school of their dreams?
Wait, I'm not sure I understand who this student is.
I don't know who the student is exactly.
I knew you weren't going.
There's the argument that some students, because either they didn't get the same kind of preparation, say in high school, that putting them into a setting where other students have, you know, the very best test scores and grades and that sort of thing, that they end up mismatched in these schools, and they don't finish at the same rates as classmates who, for perhaps reasons that are not completely democratic and not meritocratic, had a better background before they got to college.
Well, the best I can say in response to that is my experiences do not reflect that concern. In fact, they reflect the opposite. And I want to tell quickly a story of a Latino male who was suggested by one of my colleagues in the social psychology department at Harvard to work with me on a particular project, and he turned out to be absolutely brilliant. And yet he wanted to go to law school, and he kept taking the LSAT, and he kept not doing well on it. He took a practice version of it 30 times and did not do well. And yet he ultimately got major awards for the work he did at Harvard College. He got major awards after he graduated. And he was a contributor on many levels to the other students in his class. Now, I mention him because he grew up poor, and he didn't have all of the test prep and access to all of these other opportunities that some of his classmates had. But he had talent, and if Harvard Law School were dependent only on his LSAT scores, he wouldn't have been admitted. But he had enormous talent, so I think the problem is that we're using a very slim limb of excellence as a means of determining who's going to move on and do well and become a leader, and who's going to be kept out of the process altogether.
Let's go to the phones now. We have Linda on the line in Flower Mound. Hi, Linda.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Well, I actually can kind of speak to this point, too. As soon as I heard you mention the Posse program, I got very excited. There were Posse. They had that. They did that at the university that I went to. And I know that it helped a lot of kids in, you know, and get into college and succeed in college. But there were some that I think really didn't acclimate to the environment as well. And they said that, you know, their friends in the Posse program were putting on an act, and that was the only reason that they fit in the university, and that kids looked down on them, and kids, you know, made assumptions, and that when they tried to be themselves, they didn't fit in the way that the kids who, you know, put on an act and maybe played the stereotypes and were, you know, sort of more what they expected from kids of that socioeconomic or racial background. And so, you know, how do you... I guess we've been talking about social things as well as academic things, and how do you change the culture? How do you help those kids in the Posse program who have that sort of experience?
Okay, I think that's – your name is Linda, right?
That's Linda, yes.
Okay. I think it's a – she's making a great point, and her question is certainly fair. How do you change the environment at an institution where most of the people are the children of privilege, and you have a small group of people who are struggling but who are being reinforced and being encouraged by their posse? And I think that the answer is we need to have more posses, not less, so that the students who are dominant will become students who have experienced much more collaborative learning opportunities rather than students who have spent all their time being competitive individualists. I'm not against competitive individualism per se, but I don't think it should dominate our institutions of higher education when one of the important missions of most of these institutions of higher education is not only to educate people who are going to be rich, it's about educating people who are going to be leaders in this society. And in that instant, or in that context, we want leaders who are capable of collaborating and capable of collaborating with lots of people who are from different backgrounds and different and have had different experiences.
Let's go next on the phone to Becky in Dallas. Hi, Becky.
Hi.
Hi, go right ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. I am actually a professor at a Texas university, and I just wanted to applaud your guest today. I've employed a lot of the techniques in the classroom with regards to collaborative learning, and I do think that that is really where it is at. And I saw scores increase in my classroom. We would do things like group tests and group case studies and group presentations. And on the standardized tests that I had to give after my courses or during my courses, I saw scores go up. I saw participation go up. I saw light bulbs go on. And students who maybe normally were struggling really made enormous gains. So I can tell you firsthand that a lot of the techniques that she's talking about and the way you approach your classroom as more of a collaborative environment versus, you know, I'm the teacher with all the power at the front of the classroom, it makes a tremendous difference in the how well the students do. My challenge has been, one, that sometimes other faculty don't, that's a struggle, getting other faculty to see that this really does make a difference.
Becky, I'm going to jump in because we only have about a minute left for Lonnie to comment, and there was so much interesting stuff in what you just had to say. Would you like to respond to any of that, Lonnie?
I would love to get Becky's email address and contact her because I want to hear more about what she's doing. I feel quite affirmed by her intervention, and I think what she's saying is mirroring and complementary to what I'm trying to say, which is she was building a collaborative environment, and that kind of group representation seemed to turn on the lights for a lot of students. That's fantastic.
Any suggestions for bringing along Becky's colleagues who don't necessarily recognize the value in this yet?
Well, I hope they read my book and they also go to Becky's class and sit there and observe the way in which the students become much more invested personally in doing well and collaboratively in helping others to also do well.
Lonnie Guinier is Bennett Bosky Professor of Law at Harvard Law School. Her new book is called The Tyranny of the Meritocracy, Democratizing Higher Education in America. Lonnie, it's been a really interesting conversation. I so appreciate the time that you've made to speak with us.
Well, I'm delighted to have been invited, and I have to tell you, I'm absolutely thrilled to hear from Becky.
Well, Becky, maybe you can Google Lonnie, get her email address, and you guys can have a chat. So thanks so much.
That'd be great.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think, and you can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.